Chapter 5. The enemy will use every wile of battle against you, every truth you have learned herein, every hard lesson that war has taught you. The general who thinks himself unique in his learning is merely the next head hanging on the wall. Codex Astartes. The Ultramarine's plan was simple, but that did not mean it was easy. The Generatorium and the adjoining defense laser complex were always the primary objective for the Space Marines in Port Memnor. But it was the endgame, the capstone of the campaign, to bring the planetoid to heel. Any tactician of the Imperial Guard would identify a cascade of objectives to be toppled one at a time, culminating in the conquest of the defense lasers to make the spaceport safe for Imperial use. Space Marines did not think like that. They did what had to be done, fight the battle that had to be fought, and ignore everything else. They would not reduce the xenophile strongholds, fortify the parliament and places of worship, assist in the evacuation of Imperial personnel, or establish garrisons throughout the city. They would go for the throat, for the heart of the victory, trusting in their superiority in battle to make everything else irrelevant. So Captain Davinius led his squad into the lowest levels of the Generatorium, where the lights were few and the shadows were deep. It was a relic of the first days of Briseis's imperial settlement, where the burgeoning city had been fueled by fat iron boilers, surrounded by a tangle of corroded pipework. The structure had been dropped from orbit shortly after the imperial settlers had first broken ground on Port Memnor, then forgotten and crushed beneath the mass of the Generatorium for centuries. Davinius emerged into the coolant complex, enormous refrigerated storage tanks reaching 7 stories above the labyrinth of pipework. Freezing mist clung to the lower levels, swirling around the ultramarines as they burst through from below. "The objective is the defense laser command," Vox Davinius. "Through the coolant towers, into the defense complex. Do not get held up. Once we have the complex, the xenophiles will never get us out." The Generatorium workers fled at the first sight of the ultramarines. They had all heard what had happened at the Parliament House. There was no impediment to the squad making their way up to the mid-levels, moving towards the laser complex adjoining the Generatorium. Soon the towering vault of the laser cathedral loomed ahead. 6 enormous laser cannons stood around the huge circular hall, forming a great place of worship, dedicated to the Omnissiah. An icon of the machine cult stood in the center of the arena-like central expanse, a hooded titan surrounded by a cog halo and carrying the power axe that symbolized the priesthood of Mars. The first magi to oversee the defense laser's construction had consecrated this place, the rituals repeated by every Magos since up to Skepteris. "Hold this place," said Davinius. "Odorak, barricade the entrances, take whoever you need. I need to get onto the Vox and bring as many workers in as we can to help. The xenophiles will strike as soon as they realize we have moved, but we will throw them back to their Tau masters in pieces." "They cannot weed us out of here," said Odorak, looking around the cathedral. "This monument to imperial might, this icon of majesty. We can hold this for years, my brothers." "I wish the xenophiles had been rooted out first," Vox Davinius, as the squad spread out to cover all the ways in. "And this city could have been taken without bloodshed. But they are dug in deep, my brothers. They will come to us. They will beg to die on our blades. If they will refuse the Emperor's mercy I fought so hard to show them, they will get the Emperor's wrath in its place." The laser complex was highly defensible, built to be garrisoned by Imperial forces. Destroying the xenophiles had been at the forefront of the Space Marines' mission objectives, but the ultimate goal had always been holding the defense lasers and hence securing the spaceport for Imperial transports. The xenophiles would die, and many innocent citizens, as they were forced to mobilize against the complex. but the Ultramarines would hold it. Perseus would suffer, as Divinius had sought to prevent, but the Emperor's will would be done, and the forces fighting on Agrellon would be bolstered. This battle would be won. Agrellon would be won, and this war after it. It was the Emperor's will. Divinius's thoughts were broken by the metallic howl from above. A section of the ceiling bowed in and fell, a shower of wreckage and flame pouring through. His squadmates scattered across the cathedral floor. Through the flames it descended. The hard lines of its shape were framed in the fire that shimmered against the chrome-bright surrounds of the reactors built into its chest, echoed in the blue-yellow jets of flame from the exhausts on its back. It was huge, not far shy of an Imperial Knight demi-titan in scale, one arm holding a massive multi-barreled pulse weapon and the other the glowing vanes of a shield generator. Twin reactors glowed on either side of its massive torso, its reverse jointed knees bending to absorb the shock as it hit the cathedral floor. Burning wreckage crashed into the floor around it as the missiles racked around its shoulder angled towards Divinius. The design was unmistakably Tau. The lenses in its head dilated as they focused on Divinius. Smaller machines were descending around it, their jets firing to land. Divinius had never seen anything like it, save the early battle assessments from the war on Agrellon. A new form of battlesuit. A bipedal machine with the firepower of a super-heavy tank and maneuverability equal to anything the Tau had fielded before. Until now, only a few grainy picked captures and garbled field reports attested to their existence. The Tau treatment of technology was their most blatant heresy. They created, they innovated, constantly forging new machines to fight their expansionist wars. This machine was their latest, a huge and massively armed iteration of the smaller crisis battlesuits now dropping into the cathedral behind it.
"Riptide!" shouted Divinius over the vox as he ran.
Two missiles streaked towards him, screaming on trails of white exhaust. A few strides away was the statue of the Omnisire, and Divinius dived past the folds of its sculpted robe. One missile hurtled past the statue and exploded against the far wall. The second hit the statue, blowing it in half at the waist, sending chunks of torn bronze falling in scorching rain around Divinius. The upper half toppled, the head of the statue's axe burying itself in the floor. Divinius broke from cover, snapping shots up at the riptide. Its burst cannon followed him, tracking unerringly. It could punch through power armor as if it wasn't there. Divinius dropped onto his back. He had one shot before the riptide's cannon speared right through him. He had trained for such a shot 1,000 times in the firing ranges of Macragge, against drone servitors in the Proving Grounds. Thaxos had been a better shot than he was, and Venarin was better than either. But Divinius was an ultramarine, and there was no facet of the Codex Astartes he had neglected, marksmanship included. The bolter kicked in Divinius's hand. The riptide's eye lens shattered, spilling sparks like burning blood. It would not last. The Tau battlesuits had redundant sensor systems that kept them lethal even when their primary sensors were destroyed, but it would buy seconds, and seconds were what Divinius needed. The other Ultramarines were fighting the crisis suits. Each suit was the personal war machine of a Tau Firecast veteran, armed with the exotic Xenos weapons with which that warrior was most proficient. Fusion rifles, missile pods, burst cannons. Brother Silen was down, clutching the wreckage of a ruined thigh, firing with one hand from his back. Merivos and Odorak brought one crisis suit down with combined fire. Merivos's plasma gun scorching a deep molten furrow across the battlesuit's chest, the flesh of the alien inside bubbling and popping in the heat. Divinius could see the next few moments unravelling in his mind. The pages of the Codex Astartes seemed to turn before his eyes, and every movement, every shot, was picked out in the hot glow of fate. And Davinius knew that Merivos would die. Merivos paused, gunfire streaking all around him, and took stock of the riptide battlesuit stomping around the ruined statue to finish off Davinius. Merivos saw his commander stricken, and the huge battlesuit turning its burst cannon towards him. Merivos raised his plasma gun, sighting down it, picking out the weak spots in the hulking machine, as years of sleep-taught battle lore had trained him. The plasma gun emitted a bolt of superheated plasma, the sound like tearing metal. The bolt sheared into the shoulder joint of the Riptide's gun arm. Molten handfuls of armor fell away, and the arm hung limp. The tip of the barrel scraped along the floor. The Riptide turned, its remaining sensors scanning the direction of the fire that had crippled its arm. The shoulder-mounted missile racks were full again, and they tracked towards Merivos, who paused a half-second longer to spray another stream of plasma up into the Riptide's chest. He was aiming for the reactors, mounted on either side of the torso. What little intelligence existed on the Riptide suggested the blocky armored areas housed the battlesuit's power plant, and that if breached, the machine might be destroyed. It was the only chance he had at bringing it down. The armor of the Riptide's torso held. The sensors of the half-ruined head focused in on the ultramarine, and the missile racks let loose a trio of missiles that crossed the expanse of the cathedral in a heartbeat. Merivos was caught out in the open. He had no cover and had stood still to get the shot. The missiles hammered into him, and Merivos vanished in a great plume of flame and wreckage. Davinius had seen it happen a second before the missiles had hit home. It was the way of the Ultramarines. To fight and die for one another. To hold honor above survival. Die if you must, Gilliman had written 10,000 years before. But die well.
Fall back!
Yelled Davinius into the vox, scrambling to his feet.
We will regroup! We will return! Fall back!
Runes projected onto Davinius's retina called out the status of his squadmates. Three runes were dark: Silan, Merivos, and brother Timasus. Three ultramarines dead to Tau guns in the flaming chaos of the cathedral. This should have been their victory. Davinius sprayed fire almost at random at the crisis battlesuits flitting between the defense lasers. He spotted some of the ultramarines making their way towards him, holding together in a line as they fired, keeping the battlesuits on the move to thin the fire coming down at them. Behind him was a processional, down which the servitors would approach the cathedral for the annual rituals to consecrate the defense lasers. It was one of the ways in that Davinius had earmarked to be fortified against attackers. Now it would have to serve as a way out. Past Magi of Port Memnor glowered down at him through the hoods of their bronze robes, and incense servitors droned around the rafters, casting billows of sickly smoke. Brother Vesuvio got there first after Davinius. Timasus slung over his shoulder as Vesuvio fired one-handed at the Tau closing in behind. Timasus's armor was cratered and glowing down his left side, where one of the battlesuit's fusion guns had hammered him with half a dozen shots. Timasus was almost certainly dead, and Vesuvio would not leave his squadmate behind.
"Focus fire and keep moving," ordered Davinius. "Cage your fury, brothers. Discipline. By the Emperor's will, we shall return."
The rest of Davinius's squad reached the processional, Silan's body dragged by a squadmate. There had not been enough left of Merivos to salvage.
"How did they know?"
growled Vesuvio, as the squad moved out of the cathedral and into the tangled mass of coolant ducts in the lower levels of the generatorium.
"They never knew of our objective. Not even the Procurator, nor Melinar, no one. How did the Xenos know when and where we would strike?"
As the squad reached the outskirts of the generatorium, where the workers' habs and shanties clustered around the cooling towers, they came within earshot of the huge screens that broadcast to the people of Port Memnor. And it was then they got the answer. From time to time, the Magi of Briseis would have cause to speak to the population. Sometimes to warn of a coolant leak or industrial accident at the Generatorium. Sometimes to pronounce a new ordinance conscripting citizens into the workforce. It was used rarely, especially by the publicity-shy Magos Skepteris, but the pictures and broadcast equipment needed were still stored in the Magos' quarters in the Generatorium complex. It was this that Sergeant Cianoa used to speak to Port Memnor. On dozens of screens, the cold black eyes of Cianoa's faceplate looked out across the city. He held up one hand so the pictor could see what he was carrying. It was the severed head of Magos Skepteris, seen out of its dark red hood for the first time on Briseis. A mass of ribboned flesh hung from below the neck, all that Cianoa's lightning claw had left of her torso. The Magos's jaw hung open, revealing her steel teeth and the machinery in her throat. Cables and pipes hung among the gore.
"Thus are the wages of heresy," said Cianoa.
His voice echoed among the spires of spirehabs around the Parliament building, between the chimneys of the Generatorium and across the expanse of the spaceport's landing pads. It reached into the workshops of the Chrono Rights District, the animal pens of the Slaughterman's Quarter, the millions of hab cells and shanties.
"The enemy sought to convince us the Tau were the threat on Briseis, but fate told us otherwise. The enemy sought to wage his war in the shadows, but fate brought him to light. As we hunt, so we are hunted. But on this world, we turned and fought back."
Cianoa cast the head of Magos Skepteris onto the floor of the Magos' chambers. The pictor panned down to watch it land on the sea creature's hides spread out on the floor. Cianoa's armored foot stamped down on the head, crushing the Magos' skull flat against the barnacled scales.
"The enemy cannot hide the signs of its passing. Not from the jade dragons. The black leviathan passed by here and left its mark. It left it on the Magos, the servant of the enemy, and she was cut down. It left it on your city, and it shall be purged. You who worship the dark gods, you who lust for the power of the warp, know this. Now you are hunted."
Ambassador O'Mayan watched with satisfaction as the pictor turned back to the Space Marine's face, its features hidden behind the faceplate. The screen turned black as the broadcast finished, and O'Mayan turned his attention back to the Generatorium complex. O'Mayan had wished to observe events at the Generatorium directly, and so had taken an escort of fire warriors and his detail of lower-ranked watercast to the top of a hab block overlooking the complex. The signs of battle had been apparent from the buildings above the defense laser housing, fire and explosions from the entrance of Vray Sire's firecast cadre. Like punctuation marks in the history of Briseis, the explosions had marked the end of one age and the beginning of another.
"A record, if you will," said O'Mayan.
The watercast emissary beside him, a loyal and hard-working Tau who would never rise above his current rank, clacked away on a wrist-mounted data device. O'Mayan's words were worthy of preserving, for his was one of the finest minds in all the watercast.
"Upon considering a problem," said O'Mayan, "one should never seek out the solution as one might pick out a certain star in the sky. There is never a single answer, and to hunt it is to chase one prey beast, while a thousand others like it are slumbering at your feet. Instead, we look upon the answers as the roots of a tree, dividing and rejoining, until the tip of every root is the result you desire, and to get there, you must merely follow the path of cause and effect." Let us consider the solution to the problem presented on Briseis. The Imperial elites, the Space Marines, as the Gwela know them, have the capacity to hold the defense laser complex indefinitely once they had taken and fortified the place. Thus, we place in motion events that will compromise their effort to do so. Observation, intelligence gathering, and the resultant manipulation of the Jade Dragons created several potential outcomes, each of which would generate such a compromise. The first desirable outcome is the turning of the people of Briseis further against the possibility of Imperial occupation. That is the tip of one route, so to speak, and would be achieved by a public and graphic act of violence against one perceived as a friend of the tribes of Briseis. Another route leads to the outcome of the Generatorium itself being unable to function properly without the input of an expert in its technology, of which the Imperium has mystifyingly few. Finally, the manipulation may lead to the fire-cast response, intended to bring these Jade Dragons to battle, engaging a second Space Marine force in the process of fortifying the defense laser housing. A second series of explosions rippled along the roof of the main Generatorium building, the red-orange glare flickering against the massive shapes of the cooling towers. From this distance, the glow of Crisis Battlesuit exhausts was just visible, playing across the gargoyles and arch tops of the Imperium's grotesque architecture. Quite why the Imperium of Man insisted on creating such visions of oppression escaped Omion, for whom the clean, gleaming lines of Tau cities was a vision so emblematic of peace and wisdom. Perhaps it would be a suitable study subject in the future to provide an insight into the frustratingly wayward Imperial mind.
Thus we see that true social engineering is the instigation of behaviors and events of which the only possible outcomes are beneficial to the greater good, continued Omion. To structure such a pattern, a cascading series of inevitably useful events, is the goal of every watercast intervention. In this, we see in action previous lessons on the use of an opposing force's qualities against him. The aggression and independence of the Jade Dragons, and the concept of human honor, given such import by the Ultramarines, are themselves factors in the success of this intervention. This, Ambassador, can think of no more useful tools in the work of the greater good than the Space Marines.
The emissary finished recording Omion's words. They would form part of the great body of work he would leave behind, which later watercast ambassadors would use to further refine their ways of advancing the greater good and necessary expansion of the Tau Empire. Briseis would be a useful prize, Agrellon more so, but the true contribution to the greater good would come from the wisdom Omion had gathered in solving problems such as had been presented to him in Port Memnor.
Addendum, said Omion. The fire cast win with blades and pulse rounds. The air cast win with fighter craft and bombs. The water cast win with words. And with them, we shall deliver more than all our brother castes combined.
Perhaps the fire cast warriors standing guard on the rooftop would object to that, but they all knew better than to state it out loud. They could whine about it to their captain when they were done on Briseis, if their leader survived. That reminded Omion.
Avray, sire, said Omion into his communicator. Report.
Brother Odorek crawled the last few meters across the floor of the turbine hall. Above him, what remained of the squad were swapping fire with the other Crisis battlesuits across the roof of the Generatorium building. Around him rose the din of the turbines, masking the thudding footsteps of the battlesuit that had descended on its back-mounted jets to make sure he was dead. Odorak had fallen thrown knew how far when the roof section had collapsed and one leg had folded under him, broken and useless. He had already taken pulse rounds to the chest and shoulder, punching through his ceramite and into flesh and bone. He was dying. Looking down from the roof, Davinius could see it all panning out in the same clinical slow motion as Merivus's death. Odorak rolled onto one side, hot blood spraying over the blue of his armor as he unhooked a melter bomb from his waist. He sprawled across to the massive cylinder beside him, the turbine itself, powered by the steam, superheated by the plasma reactors. The crisis battlesuit stalked into view. A fusion blaster leveled at Odorak, and Odorak ripped the pin out of the melter bomb as he clamped it onto the turbine. Davinius scanned through the situation, the sleep-taught instincts of a combat leader taking control. His squad was down to half strength. He had taken a shot to one shin that had shattered the bone, and though he could still walk, he limped through the fuzz of automatically dispensed painkillers and could feel the boot of his armor filling with blood. Vesuvio had fallen. Timosus still slung over his shoulder, drilled through the back by a volley of pulse shots a few paces from Davinius. The only way forward had been across the roof, towards the walkways and stairwells leading to the tangle of shanty tunnels where the ultramarines could lose the bulky battlesuits. But until then, there was scant cover among the gargoyles of the rooftop. In the same queasy slow motion, Odorak rolled onto his back. His helmet was gone, shredded by fusion fire, and Davinius could see Odorak mouthing some old curses of Macragg at the battlesuit looming over him. The melter bomb detonated. The turbine, Odorak, the battlesuit, and the turbine hall vanished in a white eruption of steam, shards of shrapnel punching up through the roof. The shockwave hit Davinius, and heat roared around him, everything swamped in the white wall of steam rushing up from the explosion. Somewhere in the storm and bedlam, the rest of the turbine hall roof collapsed. Davinius felt the world yawning open beneath his feet, and he fell, every sense overwhelmed. Impacts hammered at him from every direction, as if 1,000 stone fists were pummeling him. He couldn't even tell when he landed. The din ended and he was down, one side crushed into the splintered flagstones of the floor. The ruins of the turbine hall came into view as the steam dissipated. Odorak and the crisis battlesuit were gone, shredded into nothing by the eruption of shrapnel. Davinius clambered to his feet, as painfully and unsteadily as a crippled old man. His bolter was gone. He still had his bolt pistol and his power sword scabbarded. The icons on his retina were dark. His helmet was dented and one eyepiece was fractured, a black spider's web cast over his field of vision. His leg was numb and wavering beneath him, and the internal breastplate of bone was cracked. He could feel the splinters of bone floating free beneath the skin of his chest. An unaugmented human's chest would have been crushed. Anyone but a space marine would have been dead 12 times over. The turbine hall was full of wreckage. The destroyed turbine had burst open in a great torn spray of ripped metal. The structures crisscrossing the hall fallen. Chunks of smouldering wreckage were everywhere. The endless drone of the turbine hall was stuttering and uneven. The other turbines on the verge of tearing themselves apart. Movement caught Davinius's eye, looming above the shattered turbine. Through the billows of steam emerged the head and shoulders of the Riptide battlesuit. Its gun arm was completely gone, torn off in the fall from the rooftop, its own jets not quick enough to engage. The desert colours were blistered and scraped away, revealing streams of bare metal underneath. Armor segments and loose components hung from the war machine, and the head in which its eyepieces were mounted was half crushed and wrenched sideways. Divinius could make out the whining of the Riptide's damaged servos over the turbines. The Riptide stalked through the wreckage towards Divinius, the single remaining lens narrowing to focus. It had seen him. Divinius drew his sword and pistol. The Riptide cycled two remaining missiles on its launcher. Divinius could hide. He could hunker down behind cover and hope the missiles didn't tear him apart where he sheltered. He could run and hope that the Riptide didn't just draw a bead on him as he fled, launching a missile to hit him square in the back. Divinius chose neither option. He ran at the Riptide, pistol up and hammering fire out at the Riptide's mechanical face. Bolt shells burst around its shoulders. Divinius vaulted a bank of torn metal, ignoring the bolts of pain rippling down his leg and through his chest. The Riptide was, like many war machines of the Tau, designed to kill from afar. No Xenos species possessed superior firepower technology to the Tau. That was how the Tau fought, holding off the enemy, pinning them down and herding the disposable auxiliaries of their client races forward to deal with the bloody melee of battle. It was in that melee that a space marine excelled. The ways of the Imperium did not change rapidly, but the space marines could learn to fight a new form of enemy rapidly enough if they had to. A space marine knew not to face the Tau at their favorite range, where they could pick their shots and make the best use of their firepower. He faced them up close, where the Tau tenets of war admonished them never to fight. The first missile streaked at Divinius. Divinius dropped and turned, letting the missile streak over him, the scorching exhaust bubbling the paint of his armor. He rolled to his feet, and the second missile, unleashed too quickly, veered from a target obscured in the smoke from the first. Twin explosions helped lift Divinius as he jumped at the Riptide. Divinius slammed into the war machine at the height of its massive chest, grabbing the upper edge of one of the twin reactors. The armor plating was hot against his hand. The Riptide's remaining arm reached up at him, a hand sliding out of its housing beneath the missile rack. Divinius drew his power sword and swung, a solid, glittering arc that cast a crescent of light through the Riptide's wrist. The mechanical hand was sliced clean off and clattered into the wreckage below. Divinius found a foothold and powered himself up onto the Riptide's shoulder, drawing back his blade and plunging it into the armor. The power field cracked armor plating, and the tip slid through circuitry and machinery, hydraulic fluid spurting like thick, oily blood. The Riptide bucked to throw Divinius off, but he held tight. Sparks sprayed out of the wound. Explosive bolts fired as the Riptide activated its emergency escape mechanism and the torso split open down the middle. The sealed atmosphere inside was vented as cold vapor. Inside was revealed the cockpit of the Riptide. The Fire Warrior pilot inside hooked up to his machine with dozens of wires, cradled in a cocoon-like pod to absorb the shocks the Riptide would suffer in battle. The Tau looked up at Divinius. Divinius thought he could detect some recognizable emotion in that alien face. Its lipless mouth was set in a grimace, and the nose slit flared wide. The three-fingered hands were forcing the controls round, trying to throw Divinius off. Divinius didn't think it was afraid. It was desperate, certainly. Injured. Angry. But not yet afraid. Divinius reached down and grabbed the collar of the pilot's jumpsuit. The pilot tried to draw a pistol from a holster next to the controls, but Divinius yanked the alien out of the Riptide, holding it above the cockpit. The pilot's feet kicked unsupported among the severed cables hanging from interfaces all over the jumpsuit.
"What species is this that butts heads with the Imperium of Man?" growled Divinius.
He didn't know if the alien could understand him, and he didn't care.
"Have you not witnessed our wrath? Have you not left your dead piled deep enough? Humanity does not kneel. Humanity is no slave species for you to exploit, alien. If you have not learned that by now, then we will teach it to you in death."
The Tau grimaced as it fought to breathe, with Divinius's gauntlet around its throat.
"I wait all this for you,"
it slurred.
"For your people. For their freedom. For the greater good."
Divinius rammed the power sword up into the Tau's stomach. The power field blew out the back half of its chest, throwing shattered ribs and torn organs across the armored carapace of the riptide. The alien's eyes rolled back and went dull, the light glinting in their black lenses extinguished. Divinius dropped the corpse at the feet of the riptide and clambered down. His squad were lost, shot down by the Tau or killed in the collapse of the turbine hall. He did not know if the same could be said for the Crisis battlesuits, so he wasted no time in making his way across the turbine hall, through the sections of the fallen roof, and out into the shantytown that clustered around the base of the building. The firefight and the explosion in the turbine hall had scared the people away, and the city surrounding the generatorium was empty. No doubt the people who lived here were well primed to evacuate the area at the first hint of an industrial accident. Divinius limped through the deserted streets, through the puddles of industrial runoff scum, and through the greasy drizzle that had just begun to fall. His vox was full of static. As he cleared the shadow of the cooling towers, it resolved into the regular patterns of a starship's beacon, and he switched the orbital vox channel.
"Divinius, to the Polar Defiance," he said.
He repeated himself, struggling to make anything out through the static.
"Stand by,"
came a weak, fuzzy voice in reply.
"We're cleaning up the signal."
The vox became a little clearer.
"Captain Divinius, this is the bridge of the Polar Defiance, communications helm."
"Report mission failure,"
said Divinius.
"The Tau have this city. All of it. Throne, forgive me. We have failed. Launch the orbital bombardment."